5. Functional Capitalist State. Part 2. The Apparatus of Control. Congress authorizes vast expansion of domestic spying. The House of Representatives approved legislation on Saturday, August 4th, that provides sweeping new powers to the government to spy on the population. It was a 227-183 vote in the Democratic-controlled House that capped a week-long campaign by the Bush administration to push through changes in laws that govern wiretapping surveillance. Anyone who opposed this legislation was branded as soft on terror. Now remember, this legislation could not have passed if the Democrats had not capitulated. And we have the widening reach of wiretapping, the incursion on the civil liberties of people in the United States. The New York Times on Monday, August 6th, put it this way. Bush signs law to widen reach for wiretapping. Restrictions are eased. Rules on eavesdropping are altered to match the program in use. Notice the terminology, match the program in use. In other words, without legal specifications, without the rights to do so, as if that ever mattered to the government of the United States, the Congress has now matched legislation to the illegal operations of the Bush administration. What are these operations? Eavesdropping on the international telephone calls and email messages of American citizens without warrants. As the New York Times says, congressional aides and others familiar with the details of the law said the impact went far beyond the small fixes that the administration officials had said were needed to gather information about, we'll call, so-called foreign terrorists. The Times continued, they said seemingly subtle changes in legislative language would sharply alter the legal limits on the government's ability to monitor millions of phone calls and email messages going in and out of the United States. The Times also remarked that the new law, for the first time, provided a legal framework for much of the surveillance without warrants that was being conducted in secret by the National Security Agency and outside the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the 1978 law that is supposed to regulate the way the government can listen to the private communications of American citizens. Quoting Kate Martin, director of the Center of National Security Studies in Washington, the Times notes in her quote, this more or less legalizes the NSA program. Ralph?
At one level, one could say, brothers and sisters, that the distinction between the National Security Administration and the Central Intelligence Agency on one hand and the FBI and all of the other domestic police operations on the other is largely formal. But it isn't quite that. The significance of allowing the National Security Agency and the CIA to have total hegemony over every communication, every utterance, every attempt to contact others on the part of citizens within the United States is that there is no legal framework with which to defend oneself. There is no longer any formal constitutional or other protection to which one has recourse. And that is the significance of these National Security Agency and CIA international spy agencies being precluded from having control over the domestic affairs of the United States. And it is more than a formal distinction because it blurs the distinction between totalitarian societies and those which have at least formal bourgeois protections. It is very significant, I think, that what has been done here has been done with the full compliance of all wings of the ruling class. The vote in the Senate was 60-28. This is a vast, overwhelming support on the part of both parties. And it's instructive to note what it is that Democrats who had to give a kind of fig leaf of justification or pretense for their actions were invoking. For one thing, Senator Russ Feingold, Wisconsin Democrat, stated, This is for 6 months, but you can't just suspend the Constitution for 6 months. Well, they not only did it, but they made very clear, as Russ Feingold is obliged to admit, that there is nothing that's going to preclude this being made permanent in 6 months' time. In fact, quite the contrary. Once it's instituted, it will be automatically, formally extended. Now, what is important, too, and I think we have to emphasize this, is that the Democrats in Congress and the members of Congress itself were virtually terrorized into compliance with this on the basis that if they don't do it quickly, they will be responsible for the next and imminent terror attack on the United States. This language is not without its importance. The Democrats in Congress were put on notice. Our national security is at risk now. Time is short. In other words, the declarations most recently, Maya, that there would be inevitable terror attacks within the United States, likely this summer, and from Iran, is being projected as a fait accompli, something that is inexorable. A terrorist attack is imminent. Failure to pass this bill will preclude the United States responding appropriately when it occurs. Thus, police state operations have been authorized on the basis that there is an imminent terror attack which has to be addressed. And the language of these legislators makes clear that they're perfectly aware of what is imminent. Representative Gerald Nadler stated, "We are being stampeded. By fear-mongering and deception, it is tantamount to being railroaded."
Ralph, we should make clear that the language, time is short, is the language of President George Bush. He was speaking from FBI headquarters, where he was meeting with Department of Homeland Security officials, and Bush said, quote, "So far, the Democrats in Congress have not drafted a bill I can sign. We are not going to put our national security at risk. Time is short. Time is short." And this is railroading Congress before it recessed for its summer vacation into passing this expansion of government reach. And what does the new law do? It changes the legal definition of what is considered, quote, electronic surveillance, end quote. The new law allows the government to eavesdrop on conversations without warrants, latching on to the giant switches, the telecommunications switches based in the United States, as long as the target of the government surveillance is, quote, reasonably believed to be overseas. But who makes this assessment? And this is significant. The new law changes who makes the assessment of who is reasonably believed to be a target. And it gives the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence the power to approve international surveillance rather than the Special Intelligence Court, the judiciary. We should make clear that the judiciary has always kowtowed to the requests of the intelligence agencies in the United States. It is, you could say, just a rubber stamp of approval. Still, there is that separation. The court's role now, its only role, will be to review and approve the procedures used by the government in the surveillance after it has been conducted. And remember, this is a secret court. It will not scrutinize the cases of the individuals being monitored. The law also gave the administration greater power to force telecommunications companies to cooperate with the spying operations. You may recall that now in the judiciary, in the courts, there are lawsuits against telecommunications companies for giving the government information and access to private telephone records. Companies now can be compelled to cooperate by orders from the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence. Ralph?
Here's what really is at issue here, brothers and sisters. The New York Times acknowledged that this National Security Administration spying operation is only the tip of the iceberg. Quote, they have never revealed the full extent of the domestic spying operations of which the NSA program is only a part. And what this new legislation stipulates is that the government may conceal all of the other vast information of which there has been only no minimal mention, let alone disclosure, that has been gathered by National Security Administration spy operations across the United States in 6 years of operation of this specific program. Now, there's one other dimension of this which gives us the opportunity to see the extent to which the apparatus of control is morphing into the architecture, so what we call here on Taking Aim, the architecture of the fascist state. The House Democratic leaders conducted their negotiations about this legislation not with other members of Congress, not even with the White House, but with the Director of National Intelligence, Michael McConnell. In fact, the Democratic versions of the legislation crafted in the House and Senate were submitted to Mike McConnell, who rejected them and then came back with his counterproposal. In fact, McConnell and Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez oversaw the entire negotiation and, furthermore, have total administrative control over the spy apparatus itself. Bush said he would veto anything that did not meet with McConnell's approval. What we have here, in essence, is the Director of National Intelligence, a political appointee, but basically the police chief, the intelligence chief, the Heinrich Himmler, dictating to Congress and determining the content of legislation and established as a figure to whom they must resort. McConnell essentially, as the New York Times put it, blackmailed the Democrats, stipulating that they will be held responsible for the imminent terrorist attack on the United States. In fact, as the Democratic Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky of Illinois stated, the White House would not take yes for an answer from the Democrats. It wasn't good enough for them to agree. They were creating a circumstance in which the Democrats had to succumb to the Director of Intelligence and his ultimata. What this capitulation of the Democratic Party in particular and the Congress in general represents is the acknowledgement that there is no longer any formal legislative or representative agency in the United States. You have the intelligence apparatus, you have the militarized dictatorship of the executive, and it is the compliance that is required and requested, short of which those who fail to so do, brothers and sisters, will be labeled culpable for terrorist attacks on the United States.
Ralph, we should mention, of course, that there are nuanced differences between the Republican and the Democratic Party, because they all represent the interests of the ruling class. It's the one big property party, be it Democratic Party or Republican Party. And it is in that nuanced differences that you have the discussion that leads to variances in legislation, because both congressional parties, both the Democrats and the Republicans, overwhelmingly passed the Patriot Act and other acts that abrogate our civil liberties.
Well, Maya, the nuances to which you refer are the old formulation of hard cop, soft cop. Reformists within the capitalist system position themselves to be able to absorb and contain potential disaffection. And so they give lip service to formal concerns that people have about the deprivation of their rights and the exploitation that is intensified, the better to be able to then canalize dissent into their arms and thereby diffuse it. That is the classic role of reformists within a capitalist order. And when the system is in crisis, and particularly when it's facing the moment of truth, when the protections and the gains are being swept away, no more important moment arrives for the ruling class than that, for the role of the collaborators, the class collaborators. And there you see them, the handmaidens, again, of the architecture of the fascist state.
Ralph, let's look at some of the particulars of this change in the NSA's ability to monitor communications. As the American Civil Liberties stated, as the American Civil Liberties Union stated, quote, it would allow the mass collection of Americans' communications, end quote, and would have the potential to, quote, permit the vast amount of data to be subsequently data mined, end quote. We have been discussing data mining over and again and what it means in terms of setting up so-called profiles of terrorists, of who is potentially a terrorist based upon your purchases, based upon your review of internet sites, based upon the language you use in your emails or on your telephone conversations. Your chit-chat with your friends then becomes the subject of what could define you as a terrorist.
Well, Maya, it's data mined. It's not just idle collection. I think we have to be very clear about the discussion we're having here, brothers and sisters. All of this is not just about monitoring alone. It's not just about picking up information. To a large extent, they don't want that information. They're not really interested in the information as such. What they're looking for, on the contrary, is the kind of dossier with which they can round you up in concentration camps when martial law is declared. What is being prepared for is the rationale and the apparatus for totalitarian control. And that means mass detention. That means the dirty wars of Argentina. That means the dirty wars of Brazil, of Paraguay, of Chile. You think that they're not coming home, brothers and sisters? Face the reality that is before us as we speak. This is what is being put in place with the imminent terrorist attack of their own making, the rationale for its implementation en masse.
It's what we call profiling. That's what they're doing with data mining, profiling the population in preparation for, as Ralph said, future preliminary detention, just like preemptive strike. This would be preemptive detention. An important article was written by Dan Egan in the Washington Post on Wednesday, August 1st, is when it was published. It's called NSA Spying Part of Broader Effort. Intelligence Chief says Bush authorized secret activities under one order. Now, this is the disclosure by Mike McConnell, to whom Ralph referred, the Director of National Intelligence. And for the first time, he publicly acknowledged that President Bush's original order allowing the warrantless wiretapping also included undisclosed activities that went far beyond the warrantless surveillance of emails and phone calls that President Bush confirmed in December 2005. He confirmed that aspect of it after its revelation by the New York Times and other publications.
Brian, he said a very particular thing with regard to that. With regard to what we've been discussing here, which is surveillance, he said this is the only aspect of our NSA activities that we will discuss publicly. It is the only aspect whose various activities have been acknowledged.
Officially,
McConnell stated. So what we're being told here is it's not just a question of the tip of the iceberg, but all of the preparations for detention and seizure and for confiscation of property and for quarantining and for rounding up people in camps and for keeping people from going on the roads even without a special military permit, all of that, which we are well aware of, is not even being discussed. So we have to appreciate here that when the bourgeois press gives us the flavor, It's like a teacup passing through a cup of water, brothers and sister. It's a pale
Not
reflection.
Not a teacup, you mean a teabag.
A teabag, excuse me. That's right, Maya, thanks. A teabag passing through a cup of water, a pale imitation of the full magnitude of what is in preparation here.
News reports over the past 20 months have detailed a range of activities linked to the program, the Washington Post notes, including data mining, which we've discussed, that identify surveillance targets and the participation of telecommunications companies in turning over millions of phone records. This is the tip of the iceberg. This is all that the administration has publicly confirmed, and they have confirmed this publicly only because of the revelations and the disclosure. But as McConnell has stated, he will not talk about what actually is in this presidential directive. That is top secret. Ralph?
Yes, and again, Kate Martin, executive director of the Center for National Security Studies, stated that we've been articulating here that what we have is the demonstration that Gonzalez and administration officials have, quote, repeatedly misled the Congress and deceived the American public about the magnitude and extent of the NSA operations. They have tried to give the false impression that the surveillance is narrow. But in fact, it is something quite other than that. And as to perjury before Congress on these substantive questions, yes, the question of Gonzalez perjuring himself is transparent. They're all liars. They're all professional liars. And the congressmen are They are, I'm looking for a particular word. They're facilitators of these lies. They are lies that are known to them to be lies as they're stated, and they are participants in the lying. That's what we have here with the Millionaires Club called Congress as this apparatus of control, this architecture of suppression is being fine-tuned and put into definitive place.
This has been going on for quite some time. And the disclosure by, or let's say the recognition that this was happening by President Bush only happened after the USA Today reported in May 2006 some of the details of the NSA acquisition from telephone companies of phone call databases. And it was only after this that President Bush confirmed the eavesdropping. He said it was limited to communications in and out of the United States involving people suspected of ties to Al-Qaeda. But what we now learn from the statement of McConnell that this presidential directive goes much further. President Bush said it was limited to these certain communications. However, what McConnell is acknowledging, as I said, is it goes much further.
Well, Maya, the New York Times article by Joe Kay on July 30th really did leave little to the imagination.
Worldwide.
Excuse me, sure. You're quite right. The article was in the New York Times, but the discussion that I was referencing here is by Joe Kay of the World Socialist website. But the article by in the New York Times, which was published a week ago Sunday, is extremely instructive because there is a metadata archive of emails and phone calls in which tens of millions of U.S. residents' phone numbers and email addresses and coordinated with the dates and times and duration of calls and messages, and all contacts and associations have been databased. And not only databased, but programmed for action with gradations, just like the color charts for Terra. We are being color charted for gradations of imminence for imprisonment. The Times reported that a handful of giant telecommunications companies have given the NSA access to switches through which this vast volume of phone and email and internet traffic will be so organized and monitored and controlled. So this is an apparatus not just of communications control, but preparing the docket sheets for our detention. Of course, all these operations violate the Fourth Amendment ban on unreasonable search and seizure. Of course, all of them violate the specific laws, such as the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Of course, they pose a fundamental threat to the democratic rights of the American people, but what the hell? They're initiated under the pretext of the war on terror. And all the various high-level former and current government officials, including former Deputy Attorney General James Comey and current Director of the FBI Robert Mueller, testified at congressional hearings to administrative domestic spying programs that these are vast in their application. There is no way to mistake what we are being told here by the New York Times. These are programs and plans and implementations that have no meaning other than for the implementation of a totalitarian state.
And, Ralph, the pretext, war on terror, is the leitmotif. It is what is repeated over and over again. When the National Intelligence Estimate, the NIE, the report that synthesizes the findings of Washington's 16 separate spy agencies, was released recently, the U.S. faces a heightened threat environment, end quote, for terrorist attacks. And only a very short, brief summary of that report, formerly entitled The Terrorist Threat to the Homeland, was released. It consisted of little more than a page and a half of, quote, key judgments. What are those judgments? Among the most significant sections of the document, it concerned Pakistan, stating that Al-Qaeda has, quote, protected or regenerated key elements of its homeland attack capability, including a safe haven in the Pakistan federally administrated tribal areas, the Fatah, end quote. And then Lebanon, the document cited Lebanon's Shia-based political and paramilitary movement, Hezbollah. And it said that Hezbollah was a potential terrorist threat to the homeland in the event that it, quote, perceives the United States as posing a direct threat to the group or Iran. And then Iraq was targeted. The NIE pointed to the centrality of the Iraq war in generating a heightened threat of terrorist attack, stating, quote, Al-Qaeda will probably seek to leverage the contacts and capabilities of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, its most visible and capable affiliate, and the only one known to have expressed a desire to attack the homeland, end quote. Now, this goes on and on. Again, over and again, a fake presentation of a terror threat. Ralph?
Well, Maya, look, I'm glad you mentioned that they are extending this to Lebanon, not just Afghanistan and Iraq, but Lebanon
and Pakistan.
And in particular, Pakistan. Because that contextualizes, you see, the pretext, the fig leaf of opposition that the Democratic Party has launched has to do with the wrong war in the wrong place scenario, i.e., because they are losing out in Iraq. Believe me, had the apparatus of butchery and control succeeded in Iraq, they would be celebrating it today. They're positioning themselves simply to shift focus to other theaters of operation for like things, to take the heat off the ruling class in Iraq itself. You see this very clearly in the Face the Nation discussion of Patrick Leahy, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, when they gave us the impression, the public at large, that their concerns were with the lies of Alberto Gonzalez before Congress. When they sought to compel Gonzalez's resignation so they could declare some sort of nominal victory while evading the fundamental questions of the spying and the quasi-dictatorial powers themselves. Let's be clear. Far from criticizing these programs, Leahy stated explicitly in this very Face the Nation meeting, I am very open to the requirements of the Bush administration that Congress amend the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And he stated that they would cooperate with the expansion of the government's ability to carry out warrantless wiretapping itself. If they need to make any changes in intelligence surveillance, we'll do it for them, Leahy stated, quote unquote.
Well, Ralph, that's the context because it's showing that the supposed opposition, Senator Leahy, is actually of like mind.
It's an enabling operation. And
yes.
If we needed to illuminate that point any more clearly, we will do so after the break with a description of Obama's call for a U.S. attack on Pakistan.
We pause now for station identification.
Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State, Part 2, The Apparatus of Control. As we paused before, Ralph was talking about Barack Obama, the Democratic presidential candidate for president. Ralph.
Well, Maya, I would remind our listeners how we called attention to the role of Barack Obama at the time of the 2004 elections when John Kerry was the nominee. Barack Obama at that time called for a preemptive strike on Tehran. He called for a missile attack on Iran. And he further stipulated the necessity to support Sharon and the Israeli state. Well, brothers and sisters, Senator Barack Obama of Illinois delivered a very instructive speech on August 1st before a Washington think tank. Speaking to the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, Barack Obama called for massive more troops to be sent to Afghanistan, and he advocated unilateral and preemptive attacks against Pakistan, and he made an across-the-board pledge to strengthen the U.S. military and intelligence apparatus. In fact, of course, we had already seen in his book, The Audacity of Hope, his support for the war on terror and the use of imperial military force wherever the U.S. claims to see, quote, an imminent threat, unquote. But he has amplified this in a recent article in Foreign Affairs, the defense and foreign policy establishment of the ruling class and of the, in particular, the Council on Foreign Relations. He stated, we must use this moment to rebuild our military and to prepare for the missions of the future. We must retain the capacity to defeat swiftly any conventional threat to our country, and we must become better prepared to put boots on the ground and to take on foes that fight asymmetrical or highly adaptive campaigns. And we must do this on a global scale. Specifically, Barack Obama added, we must add 65,000 soldiers to the army and 27,000 Marines to the standing military immediately. Now, this speech on Wednesday at the Woodrow Wilson Center was a speech that represents a common theme for the Democrats. The September 11th attacks not merely represent a challenge, but an opportunity. Quote, we didn't finish the job against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. We have to develop new capacities and capabilities to defeat this new enemy and launch a comprehensive campaign to dry up the terrorist base of support. He stated that the 21st century stateless terrorism can be defeated. And he said invasion and occupation are only part of that process. He solidarized himself fully with the war on terror, and he used the phrase to which conceals, of course, the motives of the American ruling class in launching the Iraq war namely control over oil reserves and geopolitical dominance. He said, just because a president misrepresents the locale of our enemies doesn't mean we don't have them. The terrorists are at war with us. This threat is from violent extremists. They may be a minority of the world's 1.3 billion Muslims, but this threat is real.
Ralph, I'd like to also point to another quote from Barack Obama in this speech at the Woodrow Wilson Center and ask, what is the difference between his language and that of former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld or President Bush himself? When Obama said, quote, I will not hesitate to use military force to take out terrorists who pose a direct threat to America. I will ensure that our military becomes more stealthy, agile, and lethal in its ability to capture or kill terrorists. We need to recruit, train, and equip our armed forces to better target terrorists and to help foreign militaries to do the same.
He amplifies this. I will strengthen our intelligence. This is more than an organizational chart. We will build that capacity. We will collect and analyze information, and we will carry out operations everywhere to disrupt terrorist plots and break up terrorist networks. The United States alone cannot steal every secret, penetrate every cell, act on every tip, and track down every terrorist. We should not be doing this alone. What he wants is an enforcement apparatus from dependent ruling classes in countries such as Great Britain and Japan. There you have it. You have a program of escalation on the part of the nominal reformist Democrat Barack Obama, the face of the Democratic Party's collusion and capitulation to the dictates of a very ruthless and determined ruling class of which they are inextricably bound, to which they are inextricably bound, and of which they are essential components.
And Ralph, the important underpinning of, you can say, goes hand in hand with this foreign intervention, with this militarist operation, has to be the squelching of the opposition at home as well as abroad. And that is why the Democrats support the warrantless wiretapping and the other attacks on our civil liberties. You cannot have militarist operation and allow free dissent here in the United States. I think we should also look at what is happening in Great Britain, because at the same time as you have the suppression of liberties here in the United States, you have a sweeping suppression of liberties in Great Britain. And an important article appeared in The Guardian July 26th, written by Patrick Wintour and Alan Travis. Brown, referring to Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister in Great Britain, Brown sets out sweeping but risky terror and security reforms. Brown had moved on July 25th to dominate the terror and security agenda. Wintour writes, he grabbed a Tory proposal for an integrated single border fence and challenged David Cameron to accept that the scale of terrorist threat requires an extension of detention without charge up to 56 days. Now, this is significant because there had been a long debate in the British Parliament that had opposed extending detention without charge. And as of now, there was a compromise, and there is a long detention without charge law in Great Britain. Consensus had been found in 2005 between the Tories and the Labour that allowed 28 days. And now Brown is trying to extend that to 56 days.
Maya, it's going to be extended to an unlimited period of time. And I think we have to look into at the Brown regime, the new Brown prime ministership of Great Britain, in a very clear manner. As soon as Tony Blair was scheduled for retirement, and no sooner had Brown been formally declared the replacement prime minister of Great Britain, a terror attack was launched. And what's instructive about that particular terror attack is that all of the intelligence services of the United Kingdom had full cognizance of it in advance. The nightclub bomb alert was issued 2 weeks before it actually occurred. Nightclubs, as the London Times reported on June 30th, nightclubs across Britain were warned that they would be terrorist targets, and this occurred literally weeks, days and weeks before the double car bomb attack in London, the Times has learned. This is a report from the New York Times. It goes into the particulars about the car packed with petrol nails and patio gas canisters and the green pale green Mercedes left outside the Tiger nightclub in Haymarket. All of the variables that have to do with this operation were in the hands of the police at least 2 weeks prior. In addition to which, as the World Socialist website article by Paul Mitchell on July 26th articulated, article, The London Bombing Trial, How Much Did the Security Services Know?, it emerges that this had exactly the same footprint as did the attacks of 7/7/2005. The security services had full cognizance of the operation in advance. We've done elaborate programming on this, the double agents, the operatives who were part of the intelligence services. It's the same old with the Glasgow airport bombing and with the nightclub bombings in Great Britain, timed for the onset of the Brown administration. And what does the George Brown prime ministership represent in Great Britain? He formed a government that includes not merely liberals and conservatives, but business and military and police figures. The principal person who will be counseling this government on security affairs and terrorism is Sir John Stevens, the very person who was in charge of the London police, who stipulated after the Madrid bombings that there would be exactly such a bombing in London, and who, in fact, was totally involved with the police apparatus that facilitated that bombing.
Ralph, right now, police and security services have admitted that they're tracking 2,000 individuals in Great Britain, and that's an increase of 400 in the past 9 months, and that for 900 shopping centers, sports stadiums, and other areas where large crowds gather, they are assessing them. They're having counterterrorism advisors assess them. And what's significant about all this is that the Home Office, that is the Department of State for the British government, released figures that between September 11, 2001 and March of this year, there had been arrests of 1,228 people on suspicion of terrorism. Yet, when you look at the Home Office records, more than half, 669, were released without charge. But this is after they were detained for long periods of time. The data showed that only 241 had been charged with offenses under terrorism. That's less than 20%. And how many of them have actually been convicted is much less. Now, this is reported by the New York Times itself on July 26th in an article by Jane Perlez. And it is significant that the bourgeois press is acknowledging that, although they don't state it, they are presenting the statistics that show this is a fake offense against the people of Great Britain, particularly people of color. And we must look also at what the British government is doing to the one legislator who has been extremely vocal and opposed to the war on Iraq, and that is George Galloway. But, Ralph, you have first something you want to state about the Brown government.
Well, I think it's essential that we spell out a little bit, Maya, before we deal with the question of George Galloway and the application of these policies in particular, just what we're dealing with here. Because this is a generalized phenomenon in the capitalist world. It isn't, and I mention this because There's a tendency amongst people in the United States on what passes for the left to associate all of these operations with the Bush administration as such. The Bush administration is but a small expression of the crisis of capitalism, brothers and sisters. We have shown and documented the full role of the Democratic Party in the entire ruling class. It is not within the United States alone. It is across the capitalist world and in all of the nominal states of control, Great Britain, France, Germany, Japan. Look at the composition of a Labour government now in Great Britain. People who have been placed into the positions of control are, in fact, the captains of capital and of banking capital within Great Britain, who are, as the Financial Times stipulated, injecting the private sector into the entire apparatus of governing in Great Britain. You have Sir Digby Jones, the leader of the Confederation of British Industry, as the Minister of Trade. You have the Business Council for Britain now determining policy for a Labour government. In fact, you have the head of private equity, Damon Buffini, the premier executive, who will lead a team of high-profile business leaders that includes Sir Terry Leahy, head of the supermarket chain Tesco, Virgin Air Sir Richard Branson, and Amstrad's Sir Alan Sugar. So what we're dealing with here is a venture capitalist control. Ronald Cohen, the doyen of British private equity, former Goldman Sachs partner Jane Asbett, Peter Coates.
Goldman Sachs.
Peter Coates, the internet gambling tycoon. These are the architects of the new Labour government of George Brown. The appointment of David Miliband as foreign secretary. This is a very significant appointment because this is a person totally subordinate, not just to the United States, but to the Israeli state.
And what's interesting, Ralph, is there is no actual sign of labor, no intervention of the trade unions, which was the formation of the Labour government.
And this is the context, then, of the article in The Guardian. The Brown sets out risky terror and security reforms, unquote. He moved yesterday to dominate the terror and security agenda, grabbing a Tory proposal for an integrated border fence and challenging David Cameron to accept that the terrorist threat requires extension of detention, as you have elaborated, Maya, and for large periods of time. Well, brothers and sisters, it is the 2,000 terrorist suspects who are lined up, but the millions who are being spied upon. And that is in consonance with what we are describing in the application of an architecture of fascist control within the United States itself.
And that is why it has been imperative for the British ruling class to silence George Galloway, to try to undermine his effective voice. And what happened is that on July 23rd, the House of Commons ruled on an ejection and suspension of MP George Galloway. This is the result of a witch hunt that has been specifically aimed at intimidating and silencing all opponents of the Iraq War. And Galloway is more than an opponent of the Iraq War. He is what you call the liberal voice in Great Britain. He would be suspended from the House of Commons for 18 sitting days, according to the Standards and Privileges Committee of the Parliament. And this would take effect in October when the House of Commons returns from its summer recess. However, this committee found no factual evidence against George Galloway. Its finding was, quote, strong circumstantial evidence, end quote, that his Mariam appeal received cash from the United Kingdom's Oil for Food program, quote, with Mr. Galloway's, quote, connivance. Now, we have to look at the background of this. George Galloway, an opponent of the invasion of Iraq and supporting charitable work in Iraq.
He was supporting a campaign to oppose the sanctions that were starving the population of Iraq and led to the death of 1.3 million civilians, including 750,000 children. Galloway had organized a fund for breaking the blockade. That's what his crime is, and they're attempting to suggest that the fund to which he had organized financial contributions had also received contributions from the Food for Oil program in Iraq. There isn't a scintilla of evidence for this. They're attempting to frame him, and the attempts to frame him were so grotesque that even though the Daily Telegraph in London that had published these charges was sued for libel by George Galloway, and the courts found that the charges were completely fabricated and ordered the Daily Telegraph not only to retract them but to pay him a vast sum.
£150,000.
Of damages for these lies.
That's over $300,000. And what Galloway's lawyer described is, quote, one of the most unequivocally emphatic judgments. The libel judge awarded Galloway £150,000 for the, quote, seriously defamatory charges made by the Telegraph. The judgment was upheld by a court of appeal, which ruled that the newspaper had alleged, quote, Mr. Galloway took money from the Iraqi Oil for Food program for personal gain. And this was just a repeat of the original documents of the Telegraph. In other words, not only the British court, but the British Court of Appeal has showed that this is defamatory. And here we have the House, the British Parliament, repeating all these lies.
Well, not just repeating it, Maya, but they set up a committee of the architects of the war in Iraq and the architects of the fake terror attacks in Great Britain, who then attempt to frame George Galloway for taking money. And what is the charge? He didn't check the exact origins of all the donations made to his appeal. Here's what George Galloway said. Being lectured by these people in the House of Commons and the funding of political campaigns is like being accused of bad taste by Donald Trump or being accused of slouching by the hunchback of Notre Dame. This House stands in such total ill repute on the funding of political campaigns. It's a parliament stuffed full of political parties who are in turn stuffed full of secret loans and bribes and donations from millionaires and billionaires. None of the parties here ask their millionaires and billionaires who give them and buy them with money where that money comes from. If it's a question of politicians criticizing me for fundraising, they themselves are responsible for illicit fundraising on a gigantic scale from the most dubious of sources, which they never apply to themselves, standards that they only seek to apply when they want to silence. No one more eloquent than George Galloway in calling it exactly as it is, these whores of the bourgeois world who are bribed and purchased and owned by the billionaires of finance capital are calling George Galloway out for an international fund of support for opposition to the sanction campaign in Iraq. And that, however, is a matter of great significance, because George Galloway was elected by the working class constituents of East London, of Lambeth, for his Respect and Truth Party when he broke with the Labour Party over its support for the fake war on terror and the war on Iraq. Without romanticizing George Galloway, who is a charismatic but bourgeois politician, this is a man who has called it like it is and has stood up to the ruling class the way none of these fake reformists of the Democratic Party have ever even dreamt of doing. That is why he is targeted, and his removal or suspension from Parliament is a harbinger of the dismantling of formal parliamentary rule within Great Britain, no less than it is within the United States.
Well, Ralph, it is important to stress that what the British Parliament ruled was, they quote, they say, circumstantial evidence. It's interesting. The court of law requires documentation, requires real evidence. And the courts have ruled in Great Britain under rigorous review that there isn't a scintilla of evidence. Consequently, what does Parliament say? It's circumstantial evidence. How does one speak against circumstantial evidence. It's all made up.
Well, Maya, but after all, circumstantial, schmircumstantial, there isn't any pretense that they have any evidence against this man.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, but so my point, of course, is that this is a charade in which the category of terror is deployed, as it has with the American Congress and with the terrorizing of the Democratic senators. If you don't do what we say, we will hold you liable for the terror attacks we are preparing to impose ourselves. And that is the significance, Maya, of the editorial in the London Observer on July 29th, Dangerous Steps Towards a Security State, in which they lay out that what this parliament is doing is depriving individuals of their liberty indefinitely, in which so-called terror suspects can be held without trial in places that they cannot be reached. In fact, they say such is the campaign of intimidation within Great Britain that 74% of the British public now state they favor indefinite disappearance and detention for those accused of terror. This is indeed the preparation for fascism, not only in the United States, but in Great Britain itself, brothers and sisters. When we examine how the current crisis of the system is playing out, we will address what is occurring not only in the United States and Great Britain, and in Japan, because this is a global phenomenon, and the international fight back, the building of a movement of mass resistance, will have to be done on a coordinated international scale. Brothers and sisters, those are the stakes.
This has been Taking Aim with and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State, Part 2, The Apparatus of Control, will be available on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Our programs also are available on the WBAI archive, www.wbai.org. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's PACBELL.net. We'll be with you next week.